Chapter 19. But if the reward must be directly for the work, it must not have any quantitative relation to the output of work. It is quality we want, not quantity. We want absolutely to invert the abominable conditions of the present time by which every exercise of restraint costs an author a fine. It is my personal conviction that almost every well-known living writer is or has been writing too much. And no book, no income is practically what the world says to an author, and the needy authors make a pasty independent follow. There is no respect for fine silences. If you cease, you are forgotten. The literature of the past 100 years is unparalleled in the world's history in this feature, that the greater portion of it is or has been written under pressure. It was the case with Scott, the case with Dickens, Tennyson, even with Browning, and a host of other great contributors to the edifice. No one who loves Dickens, and knows anything of the art he practiced, but deplores that evil incessant demand, that never permitted him to revise his plans, to alter, rearrange and concentrate, that never released him from the obligation, to touch dull hearts and penetrate thick skins with obtrusive pathos and violent caricature. Once embarked upon his course, he never had a moment for reconstruction. He had no time to read, no time to think. A writer nowadays has to think in books and articles. To read a book he must criticize or edit it. If he dare attempt an experiment, a new departure, comes his agent in a panic. Every departure from the lines of his previous success involves chaffering, unless he chanced to be a man of independent means. When one reflects on these things, it is only amazing that the average book is not more copious and crude and hasty than it is, and how much in the way of comprehensive and unifying work is even now in progress. There are all too many books to read. It would be better for the public, better for our literature, altogether better, if this obligation to write perpetually were lifted. Few writers but must have felt at times the desire to stop and think, to work out some neglected corner of their minds, to admit a year's work as futile, and thrust it behind the fire, or simply to lie fallow, to camp and rest the horses. Let us, therefore, pay our authors as much not to write, as though they wrote, instead of that 20 or 30 volumes, which is, I suppose, the average product, let us require a book or so, worth having. Which means, in fact, that we must find some way of giving an author, once he has proved his quality, a fixed income quite irrespective of what he does. We might, perhaps, require evidence that he was doing some work now and then, we might prohibit alien occupations, but for my own part I do not think, even that is necessary. Most authors so sustained will write, and all will have written. We are presupposing, be it remembered, the stimulus of honors and criticism, and of further honors and further emoluments. Finally, in making schemes for the endowment of original mental activity, we must not ignore the possibility of a perversion that has already played its part in the histories of painting and music, and that is the speculative financing of promising candidates for these endowments. If we are going to make research, criticism, and creation worth, while we must see to it that in reality we are not simply making it worth, while for Solomon's and Moses, to pot the yearly promise, to stimulate its modesty, to help it to its position, and to draw the major profits of the enterprise. The struggling young man of exceptional gifts who is using his brains, not to make his position, but to do his destined work, is by that at a great disadvantage in dealing with the businessman, and it is to the interest of the community that he should be protected from his own inexperience and his own self-distrust. The average whitecap or Jew could cheat a Shakespeare into the workhouse in no time, and our idea is rather to make the world easy for Shakespeare's than to hand it over to the rat activities of the smart businessman. Freedom of contract is an idea no one outside a debating society dreams of realizing in the state. We protect tenants from landlords in all sorts of ways. Our law overrides all sorts of bargains. And in the important case of marriage, we put almost all the conditions outside bargaining and speculative methods altogether by insisting upon one universal contract or none. We protect women who are physically and economically weak in this manner, not so much for their own good as the good of the race. The state already puts literary property into a class apart by limiting its duration. At a certain point, which varies in different circumstances, copyright expires. It is possible for an author, whose fame comes late, to be present as a row of dainty volumes in half the comfortable homes in the world, while his grandchildren beg their bread. The author's blood is sacrificed to the need the whole world has of cheap access to his work. And since we do him this injury for the sake of our intellectual life, it is surely not unreasonable to interfere for his benefit also, if that subserves the greater end. Now there are two ways at least in which the author may be and should be protected from the pressure of immediate necessities. The first of these is to render his copyright in his work inalienably his, to forbid him to make any bargain by which the right to revise, abbreviate, or alter what he has written passes out of his hands, and to make every such bargain invalid. He would be free himself to alter, or to endorse alterations, but to yield no carte blanche to others. He would be free also, to make whatever bargain he chose for the rights of publication. But, and this is the second proposal, no bargain he made, should be valid for a longer period than 7 years from the date of its making. Every 7 years his book would come back into his control, to suppress, revise, resell, or do whatever he liked to do with it. Only in one way could he escape this property, and that would be by declaring it void, and making his copyright an immediate present to the world. And upon this proposal it is possible to base one form and a very excellent form of paying for the public service of good writing, and so honoring men of letters and thought, and that is by buying, and, more or less, completely extinguishing their copyrights, and so converting them into contemporary classics. Throughout these papers a disposition, to become concrete is played unchecked. Always definite proposals have been preferred to vague generalizations, and here again it will be convenient to throw out an almost detailed scheme simply as an illustration of the possibilities of the case. I am going to suggest to the reader that to endow 1,000 or so authors, as authors, would be a most wise and admirable proceeding for a modern statesman, and I would ask him, before he dismisses this suggestion as absurd and impossible, to rest contented with no vague rejection, but to put to himself clearly why the thing should under present conditions be absurd and impossible. Always in the past the need of some organ for the establishment and preservation of a common tone and substance of thought in the state has been recognized. Commonly this organ has taken the form of a church, a group of churches as in America, or an educational system as in China, but all previous schemes of social and political organization have been static, have aimed at a permanent state. Our modern state, we know, can only live by adaptation, and we have to provide not a permanent, but a developing social, moral and political culture. Our new scheme must include, not only priests and teachers, but prophets and seekers. Literature is a vitally necessary function of the modern state. Let us waive for the moment the subtle difficulty that arises when we ask who are the writers of literature, the guides and makers of opinion, the men and women of wisdom, insight, and creation, as distinguished from those who merely resonate to the note of the popular mind. Let us assume that this is determined, and let us make a scheme in the air to support these people under such conditions as will give us their best. Suppose the thing done boldly, and that for every 100,000 people in our population we subsidize an author if we can find as many. Suppose we give him some sort of honor or title, and the alternative of going on writing under copyright conditions, which many popular favorites would certainly prefer, or of giving up his copyrights to the public and receiving a fixed income, a respectable mediocre income, L800 or L1000 for example. That means 400 or more subsidized authors for Great Britain, which would work out, perhaps, as 18 or 20 every year, and a proportionate number for America and the colonial states of the British Empire. Suppose, further, that from this general body of authors we draw every year 4 or 5 of the seniors, to form a sort of academy, a higher stage of honor and income. This would probably give something under 800 on this higher stage. Taking the income of the two stages as L1000 and L2000 respectively, this would work out at about L500,000 a year for Great Britain, a quite trivial addition to what is already spent on educational work. A scheme that would provide for widows and children whose education was unfinished, and for the official printing and sale of correct texts of the books written, would still fall within the dimensions of £1,000,000. I am assuming this will be done quite in addition to the natural growth of universities and colleges, to the evolution of great textbooks and criticism, and to the organization and publication of special research in science and letters. This is to be an endowment specifically for unspecialized literature, for untechnical philosophy that is, and the creative imagination. It must not be imagined that such an endowment would be a new payment by the community. In all probability, we are already paying as much, or more, to authors, in the form of royalties, of serial fees, and the like. We are paying now with an unjust unevenness. We starve the new, and deep and overpay the trite and obvious. Moreover, the community would have something in exchange for its money. It would have the copyright of the works written. It may be suggested that by a very simple device a large proportion of these payments could be recovered. Suppose that all books, whether copyright or not, and all periodicals sold above a certain price, sixpence, let us say, had to bear a defaced stamp of, for example, a halfpenny for each shilling of price. This would probably yield a revenue almost sufficient to cover these literary pensions. In addition, the books of the pensioned authors might bear an additional stamp as the equivalent of the present royalty. The annual selection of 18 or 20 authors might very well be a dispersed duty. One or two each might be appointed in some way by group universities, or by 3 or 4 of the universities taken in rotation, by such a guild of authors as we have already considered, by the British Academy of History and Philosophy, by the Royal Society, by the British Privy Council. The jury system would probably be of very great value in making these appointments. That is a rough sketch of a possible scheme presented in the most open-minded way. It would not meet all conceivable cases, so it would need to be supplemented in many directions. Moreover, it is presented with hideous crudity, but for all that, would not something of the sort work well? How would it work? There would certainly be a great diminution in the output of written matter from the 1,000 or more recognized writers this would give us, and almost as certainly a great rise in effort and deliberation, in distinction, quality, and value in their work. This would also appear in the work of their ambitious juniors. Would it extinguish anything? I do not see that it would. Those who write trivially for the pleasure of the public would be just as well off as they are now, and there would be no more difficulty than there is at present for those who begin writing. Less, indeed, for the 1,000 subsidized writers, at least, would not be clamorously competing to fill up magazines and libraries. They might set a higher and more difficult standard, but they would leave more space about them. The thing would scarcely affect the development of publishing and book distribution, nor injure nor stimulate except by raising the standard and ideals of writing newspapers, magazines, and their contributors in any way. I do not believe for one moment the thing would stop at such a subsidized body of authors, such a little aristocracy of thought, as this project presents. But it would be an efficient starting point. There are those who demand a thinking department for Army and Navy, and that idea admits of extension in this direction. This organized general literature of mine would be the thinking organization of the race. Once this deliberate organization of a central ganglion of interpretation and presentation began, the development of the brain and nervous system in the social body would proceed apace. Each step made would enable the next step to be wider and bolder. The general innervation of society with books and book distributing agencies would be followed by the linking up of the now almost isolated mental worlds of science, art, and political and social activity in a system of intercommunication and sympathy. We have now already in the history of the world one successful experiment in the correlation of human endeavor. Compare all that was accomplished in material science by the isolated work of the great men before Lord Verulam, and what has been done since the system of isolated inquiry gave place to a free exchange of ideas and collective discussion. And this is only one field of mental activity and one aspect of social needs. The rest of the intellectual world is still unorganized. The rest of the moral and intellectual being of man is dwarfed and cowed by the enormous disproportionate development of material science and its economic and social consequences. What if we extend that same spirit of organization and free reaction to the whole world of human thought and emotion? That is the greater question at which this project of literary endowment aims. It may seem to the reader that all this insistence upon the supreme necessity for an organized literature springs merely from the obsession of a writer by his own calling, but, indeed, that is not so. We who write are not all so blinded by conceit of ourselves that we do not know something of our absolute personal value. We are lizards in an empty palace, frogs crawling over a throne. But it is a palace, it is a throne, and, it may be, the reverberation of our ugly voices will presently awaken the world to put something better in our place. Because we write abominably under pressure and for an honored bread, nonetheless we are making the future. We are making it atrociously, no doubt. We are not ignorant of that possibility, but some of us, at least, would like to do it better. We know only too well how, that we are out of touch with scholarship and contemplation. We must drive our pens to live, and push and bawl to be heard. We must blunder against men an ampler training on either side would have made our allies. We must smart and lose our tempers, and do the foolish things that are done in the heat of the day. For all that, according to our lights, we who write are trying to save our world in a lack of better saviors. To change this mental tumult into an order of understanding and intention in which great things may grow. The thought of a community is the life of that community, and if the collective thought of a community is disconnected and fragmentary, then the community is collectively vain and weak. That does not constitute an incidental defect, but essential failure. Though that community have cities such as the world has never seen before, fleets and hosts and glories, though it count its soldiers by the army corps, and its children by the million, yet if it hold not to the reality of thought and formulated will beneath these outward things, it will pass, and all its glories will pass, like smoke before the wind, like mist beneath the sun. It will become at last only one more vague and fading dream upon the scroll of time, a heap of mounds and pointless history, even as are Babylon and Nineveh. Zi. The man's own share, in this manner it is that the initial proposition of New Republicanism works itself out. It shapes into the rough outline of an ideal new state, a new republic, a great confederation of English-speaking republican communities, each with its non-hereditary aristocracy, scattered about the world, speaking a common language, possessing a common literature and a common scientific, and, in its higher stages at least, a common educational organization, and it indicates in crude, broad suggestions the way towards that state from the present condition of things. It insists as a cardinal necessity, not indeed as an end, but as an indispensable instrument by which this world state must be made and sustained, upon a great, a contemporary, and a universally accessible literature, a literature not simply of thought and science but of power, which shall embody, and make real and living the sustaining dreams of the coming time, and which shall draw together, and bring into intelligent correlation all those men and women who are working now discontentedly and wastefully towards a better order of life. For, indeed, a great number of men and women are already working for this new republic, working with the most varied powers and temperaments and formulae, to raise the standard of housing, and the standard of living, to enlarge our knowledge of the means by which better births may be attained, to know more, to educate better, to train better, to write good books for teachers, to organize our schools, to make our laws simpler and more honest, to clarify our political life, to test and reorganize all our social rules and conventions, to adjust property to new conditions, to improve our language, to increase intercourse of all sorts, to give our ideals the justice of a noble presentation. At 1,000 points the new republic already starts into being. And while we scattered pioneers and experimenters piece together our scattered efforts into a coherent scheme, while we become more and more clearly conscious of our common purpose, year by year the old order, and those who evangelist to the old order, die and pass away, and the unhampered children of the new time, grow up about us. In a few years this, that I call New Republicanism here, under I know not what final name, will have become a great world movement conscious of itself and consistent within itself, and we who are making now the crude discovery of its possibility, will be working towards its realization in our 1,000 different ways and positions, and coming to our help, to reinforce us, to supersede us. To take the growing task out of our hands will come youth, will come our sons and daughters, and those for whom we have written our books, for whom we have taught in our schools, for whom we have founded and ordered libraries, toiled in laboratories, and in waste places and strange lands, for whom we have made saner and cleaner homes and saner and cleaner social and political arrangements, foregoing 100 comfortable acquiescences, that these things might be done. Youth will come to take over the work from us, and go on with it in a bolder and ampler manner than we in these limited days dare to attempt. Assuredly youth will come to us, if this is indeed to be the dawn of a new time. Without the high resolve of youth, without the constant accession of youth, without recuperative power, no sustained forward movement is possible in the world. It is to youth, therefore, that this book is finally addressed, to the adolescents, to the students, to those who are yet in the schools, and who will presently come to read it, to those who being still plastic can understand the infinite plasticity of the world. It is those who are yet unmade who must become the makers. After 30 there are few conversions and fewer fine beginnings. Men and women go on in the path they have marked out for themselves. Their imaginations have become firm and rigid even if they have not withered, and there is no turning them from the conviction of their brief experience that almost all that is inexorably so. Accomplished things obsess us more and more. What man or woman over 30 in Great Britain dares to hope for a republic before it is time to die? Yet the thing might be. Or for the reunion of the English-speaking peoples. Or for the deliverance of all of our blood and speech from those fouler things than chattel slavery, child and adolescent labor. Or for an infantile death rate under 90, in the 1,000 and all that would mean in the common life. These and 100 such things are coming now, but only the young know how near they may be brought to us. As for us others, we plant a tree never believing we shall eat the fruit, we build a house never hoping to live there. The desert, we believe in our hearts, is our home and our destined grave, and whatever we see of the promised land we must see through the eyes of the young. With each year of their lives they come more distinctly into conscious participation with our efforts, those soft little creatures that we have figured grotesquely as dropping from an inexorable spout into our world, those weak and wailing lumps of pink flesh more helpless than any animal, for whom we have planned better care, a better chance of life, better conditions of all sorts, those lavable souls who are at first helpless clay in our hands, presently insensibly have become helpers beside us in the struggle. In a little while they are beautiful children, they are boys and girls and youths and maidens, full of the zest of new life, full of an abundant, joyful receptivity. In a little while they are walking with us, seeking to know whither we go, and whither we lead them, and why. Our account of the men-makers is not complete until we add to birth and school and world, the increasing element of deliberate cooperation in the man, or woman we are seeking to make. In a little while they are young men and women, and then men and women, save for a fresher vigor, like ourselves. For us it comes at last to fellowship and resignation. For them it comes at last to responsibility, to freedom, and to introspection and the searching of hearts. We must, if we would be men-makers, as the first and immediate part of the business, correct and finish ourselves. The good new Republican must needs ask and ask repeatedly, what have I done, and what am I doing with myself, while I tamper with the lives of others? His self-examination will be no monstrous egotism of perfectibility, indeed, no virtuosity of virtue, no exquisite retreat and slinking out of the race, where that immortal garland is to be run for, not without dust and heat. But he will seek perpetually to gauge his quality, he will watch to see himself the master of his habits, and of his powers, he will take his brain, blood, body, and lineage as a trust, to be administered for the world. To know all one can of oneself in relation to the world about one, to think out all one can, to take nothing for granted except by reason of one's unavoidable limitations, to be swift, indeed, but not hasty, to be strong but not violent, to be as watchful of oneself as it is given one to be, is the manifest duty of all who would subserve the new republic. For the new republican, as for his forerunner the Puritan, conscience and discipline must saturate life. He must be ruled by duties, and a certain ritual in life. Every day and every week he must set aside time to read and to think, to commune with others and himself. He must be as jealous of his health and strength as the Levites of old. Can we in this generation make but a few thousands of such men and women, men and women who are not afraid to live, men and women with a common faith and a common understanding, then, indeed, our work will be done. They will in their own time take this world as a sculptor takes his marble, and shape it better than all our dreams. The End. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.